And I just want to say to you, if you're a visitor, you're especially welcome. We're so glad that you're here. And as we always say, you don't have to sign up to be part of BC3. You don't have to kind of believe in anything particular. We are a worshiping community, and we just have a habit of coming together. And we just love having you with us. Am I doing something wrong? Sorry. Is that better? Okay. Yet I'm aware that people can get into the habit of coming to church and participating in worship, and then for one reason or another, struggling to relate to the people in that church, struggling to kind of interact with those people that are there. And there can be thousands of reasons for that, thousands of reasons. I don't know, I want to interact with you too, so I'm
looking somewhere here, that's all right.
There can be thousands of reasons why people, you know, might come to church and kind of dive out and meet at the end. But what I want to say to you is that that's not the plan. That's really not the plan. That's not what God intended for church to be. Christianity is not about a set of abstract beliefs which are disconnected from the way we live our lives. Faith starts in our minds, starts in our heads, but it is completed, it is perfected in our actions. Faith starts in our mind, but it is perfected, completed in our actions. And practically speaking, over the next month, we've got a couple of things, a couple of opportunities that we'd like to invite you to. For some reason, I did the text very small this morning. I hope it's going to be okay. We'd like to invite you to a couple of events. One is Pancakes and Prayer, which will be in this room. And we're going to be inviting also people from Broadmead downstairs to come and join us. And we're going to have some pancakes and pray. It's all in the title. And in March, we're having an away day. We haven't had an away day, I think, for a couple of years now. And we're going to be in Clevedon. And it's going to be a beautiful sunny day. I already know that. It's going to be wonderful. Clevedon is a kind of an oasis for the whole of the UK. They never have any rain there. They're quite concerned about it. And we're going to be there in Clevedon, and we're going to be there together in the morning, and then we're going to be doing something fun in the afternoon. And it's about 25 minutes away from the city center of Bristol, so it's real close. So we would love you to be part of that as well. And this morning we're taking a break from the book of Ephesians. We've been there for 2 or 3 weeks now. And I just wanted to turn to John 21 and address the issue I just mentioned about relating to Jesus and relating to other people and how that works. Because in John 21, we see a series of dialogues and situations that kind of give us an indication of how that's going to work for the disciples, Jesus' friends, and then how that might work even for us. And I want to make an appeal for the authenticity of this account, okay? I want us to read this account and to, in our own minds, understand that this is not just some story, but it is a narrative account of something that really happened. A conversation about something that really happened. John is not just spouting some kind of dogma. What happened on that beach that morning was extremely important to him. And he was an eyewitness, and he brought that account for the rest of his life. John was burned in boiling oil. He was sent to a penal colony in his 90s, and he refused to recant this account. So as the frying pan, if you like, was frying up, and they were about to chuck him in, they said, all you got to do is just say it didn't happen. He said, you got to be kidding. It happened. It happened. And that's a powerful testimony, isn't it? To what really happened in the real situation in this life, in this story. John writes his gospel, but he never uses the pronoun I or me. He would never dream of doing that. And yet he's all over this gospel. He's all over it. It's even at the beginning of chapter 21, you see the list of names of people who are going on this fishing trip. And when they count the fish, it's 153 fish. It's not 154, 152, or around 150. It's 153 fish. This man held those fish in his hands as they counted them. And this is very much what John is about. And I just want to take a little hiatus out of the main message just to think about the authenticity of his account for a minute. If you just turn back at the top of the page, or actually turn back over the next page, John 20. Let's just read from the beginning of John 20. Early on the first day of the week, while it was still dark, Mary Magdalene went to the tomb and saw that the stone had been removed from the entrance. She came running to Simon Peter and the other disciple. This is John's name for himself. The one who Jesus loved. That's what he calls himself. And said, they've taken the Lord out of the tomb and we don't know where they've put him. So Peter and the other disciples started for the tomb. Both were running, but the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first. He bent over, looked in at the strips of linen lying there, but did not go in. Then Simon Peter came along behind him and went straight into the tomb. This man was there. He was there. He was racing Peter, and because he was a better runner, he got there first. But because of who he is, he stood at the entrance and looked inside. Peter comes barreling along the, and he's not stopping for nothing. He goes, boom, right into the tomb. And John is there, and he's saying, I was there, this has happened. This is the little race that Peter and I had. Well, look at the end of chapter 20, and this is actually on the top, just above 21, verse 30. He says, Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. He says, I saw Jesus do these things, and I want you to believe that he is the Son of God, that he is the Messiah. And because you believe, there will be a transformation in the very essence of who you are. There will be a transformation in every minute of every day of your life because you believe. Well, look at John 21. They're on the boat, and someone from the beach calls out. Look at verse 7, John 21. Then the disciple whom Jesus loved, John, said to Peter, "It is the Lord." As soon as Simon Peter heard him say, "It is the Lord," he wrapped his outer garment around him, for he had taken it off, and jumped into the water. John, he can feel the smack of the warm air on his face of that morning on the beach. And he turns to Peter and says, "It's the Lord." Peter, who's standing there, who's just wearing kind of like a loincloth, gets his coat, puts his coat on, and jumps in. This is a man who was present. And the conversation continues word for word as Jesus and Peter are walking on the beach. John is walking behind them, eavesdropping on the conversation. Look at verse 24. "This is the disciple who testifies to these things and who wrote them down. We know that his testimony is true. Jesus did many other things as well. If every one of them were written down, I suppose that even the whole world would not have room for the books that would be written." So the appeal I want to make to you and to me this morning is to say, all of what we're talking about this morning, all of what we talk about every Sunday, is not just a set of ideas. It's not just a set of fanciful notions or beautiful thoughts. It has somehow got to transform your life. Because if it's not transforming your life, you haven't understood it. If it's not transforming your life, you haven't understood it. And the whole message of the Bible is that when people experience Jesus, a change reaches down to the minutiae of their life, and they become different people, and they become part of something bigger than themselves in a direct and personal way. And if you are going through the motions, and if you're coming to church and you're singing the songs and you're enjoying it and all that, but you know you're going through the motions, you know that when you step out of here, it's like it never happened, and you're going to carry on with your life, will you stop doing that right away? Please stop doing that right away. Because you haven't understood anything yet. You haven't understood anything yet. Now, the final chapter of John is not about John, it's about Peter. And this is actually another sign of authenticity. Peter has been... John's writing this about 90 AD, which is about 55, 60 years after this happened. And he's writing it after... Peter died 64 AD, and so Peter's been dead for 25 years by the time he's writing this account. And John and every other gospel writer writes about a massive failing in Peter's life. And if they were writing propaganda, they would never do that. Propagandists never write about people's failings. They always, you know, big them up. But each one of the gospel writers, including Mark, who got his source data from Peter, writes about a tremendous failure in Peter's life. And we're going to think about the fallout of that failure as we think about how what it means for the gospel to actually transform us deep in the center of our being. You'll remember, don't you, that on the night that Jesus was betrayed, Peter followed him and Jesus and the soldiers, and he went into a courtyard, and while he was in the courtyard warming himself, he could see Jesus just in the building there, and they were trying him. And three people come up to Peter, and they say, "Hey, you were with Jesus." And he denies and denies and denies, and with a third time he denies with a curse. And then he steps out weeping bitterly. And so Peter comes into this situation needing a real solution. He comes into the situation as a failure. And if his failure is worse because he was so boastful and strident in saying that he would fight for Jesus, that's what makes his failure even worse. And over the time between Jesus' resurrection and now, at this point, they've seen Jesus a couple of times, but Jesus hasn't mentioned Peter's failure. And Peter's living in anxiety. He's living with sadness. He has some kind of void. And it's difficult because the disciples have been competing with each other all along. And now he's sitting there thinking, if they only know what I did, they would never want to talk to me again. And you know, that might well be why we struggle with church, isn't it? That might be why we struggle with church. Because church, any kind of group of people, can often become defined by competition. And certainly churches do. You know, I'm more holy than you or whatever it is. And it could become competitive. Or we could be sitting here thinking, you know, if these people in this room saw who I really am, then they would never want to talk to me again. They would never want to be my friends. And he's living with anxiety. And he's locked in some kind of stasis in his relationship with God. And he has the distress of knowing that not only does he not live up to everybody else's values, he doesn't even live up to his own values. And he's the fear of people judging him and sitting in judgment on him. And this is where Peter is. He's overreached himself and let everybody down. And maybe that's how you feel. Maybe you're saying, yeah, it's okay for you to stand there and spout all this about being a family and everything because you're morally perfect. Which I'm not. But maybe this is how you feel. I can't connect with these people. They're going to put me down, or they'll judge me, because I'm a mess. We're all messes here this morning. Okay? When I meet you, I automatically assume you're a basket case. Sorry. Personally, I'm a basket case. Every person I've ever met is a basket case. I automatically assume you're a mess. You've got nothing to prove. That's just the way I assume you are. Because that's the way I am. And that's the way I just have learned everybody else is too. And here's Peter. He can't do anything. He can't do nothing. He's got to do something. So he says, "Let's go fishing." And they go out in the night because they fish in the night because the fish then come to the top to where they can catch them. And they catch nothing. And then the next morning, as the sun's coming out, they see this person on the beach. He says, "Throw the net to the other side." And they throw the net on the other side. And suddenly the nets are breaking with these 153 large fish. And John turns to Peter and he says, "It's the Lord." And Peter puts on his cloak and jumps into the water. And in Peter's response, we see the first step that I believe we should all be taking as we think about relating to this truth in a very real way. Because he makes a choice between righteous self-righteousness and true righteousness. Look at verse 7 again. "Then the disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, 'It's the Lord.' And as soon as Peter heard him say, 'It is the Lord,' he wrapped his outer garment around him, for he had taken it off, and jumped into the water. The other disciples followed in the boat, towing the net full of fish, for they were not far from shore, about 100 meters. When they landed, they saw a fire burning, and coals there with fish on it, and some bread." See, we all fail all the time. But the dividing line is how we respond to that failure. The dividing line between us is what we do with our failure. That's what counts. The person who's been touched by God's Spirit has pain in his sin, and he catches a glimpse of Jesus on the shore, if I can put it this metaphorically. And Jesus gives him something to do, and he just does it out of faith. And something great happens, and then he sees you know what? He can smell the fish cooking. He can smell the fresh bread, and he just dives in and runs to Jesus because he wants to be reconciled to Jesus. He wants a lifting of that burden. He sees the goodness of Jesus. He sees the bounty of Jesus, and he runs to him with open arms. One disciple shows another disciple and says, "Look, there's the Lord," and he dives in and comes to Jesus. This is the way to deal with our failure. This is how we deal with the fact that we're failures. Just come to Jesus and come as a failure and say, "I'm a failure. I need you to change me." But others refuse. And the reason why they refuse is because they are locked into self-righteousness. Self-righteousness. And they made choices and they got into situations. And I say, "Oh, God doesn't agree with my choices. Boo-hoo. You know, God doesn't agree with me." And then they say, "Well, you know what? If God disagrees with my choices, then he's refusing to accept me." And they say, "You know what, God? If you refuse to accept me, I refuse to accept you. You hate me, I'll hate you." And they put their head down and they cross their arms. And they say, "Bad God. Bad God." When you feel guilty, the big litmus test is what you do with that. Do you come to Jesus to be cleansed? Or do you find yourself sitting in judgment on God, creating a fiction where you imagine yourself to be more moral, more righteous, more loving than God? So many people do. They have this fiction that somehow they're more moral than God. They're more upright. They're more righteous than he is. Either we come to him for forgiveness, for his righteousness, or we cross our arms and insist on our own righteousness, and we reject his offer, even telling ourselves that we're more righteous than he is. Come on. The righteousness of God is vindicated in his actions. The righteousness of God is perfected in his actions. Because God in Christ takes off his cloak and allows himself to be crucified for those who are his enemies. That's the most moral thing the world has ever seen. Someone who is perfect allowing themselves to be crucified for their enemies. That's morality on a scale that we cannot begin to imagine. And that's the morality of God. That's the righteousness of God. I don't know if I can put this in a persuasive way, but Jesus took God's anger towards his sin. And as you come to him now and say, "Listen, I screwed up again," it still smiles all the way. It still smiles all the way. It's an open arm. It's a new transformation. It's a new day. And then we can move on. And then we can be part of a group. Because we're no longer competing with people, and we're no longer worried about their judgment. Because we've received from him a righteousness that is wonderful. And we can start loving and feeding. Look at verse 15. When they finished eating, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" "Yes, Lord," he said, "you know that I love you." Jesus said, "Feed my lambs." Again, Jesus said, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" He answered, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." Jesus said, "Take care of my sheep." The third time he said to him, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" And Peter was hurt because Jesus asked him the third time, "Do you love me?" He said, "Lord, you know all things, and you know that I love you." Jesus said, "Feed my sheep." No recrimination, no guilt trip. Just, "Do you love me? Okay, feed my sheep." Three times, and the same number as Peter's rejection of Christ. And with a mounting passion, he says, "You know I love you. You know all things. You know I love you." Loving Jesus and feeling his love for us is the foundational experience of the gospel. Okay? Loving him and knowing his love for us. This is what we are hoping to experience this morning. This is what I'm hoping to experience. To know his love for me and to love him back. This is what we hope that you are experiencing in this very moment, in this place. To know that he loves you and to love him back. This is the foundational experience that we're aiming for in everything we do on these Sunday mornings. Knowing his unconditional, complete, exaggerated, mega love for us and loving him back. How can I have the courage to stop justifying myself and be transparent and ask for forgiveness? Well, I'm drawn by love. Regardless of where you've been, regardless of what you've done, there's an encounter of love that I long for myself, and I certainly long for you, that we can experience this morning again, that love for us, even in our failure. To know again that love, and then him saying to us, do you love me? Because I sure love you. Because I sure love you. The morality of God is evidenced in that love. God's morality is evidenced as he shows that love. And our morality, our response to him, is evidenced in the same way. As we experience his love, what we've got to start doing is we start serving people. Our love for him, and you know you've experienced his love for you, you know that you're loving him back when you become interested in serving other people, especially serving the people of God. We are here because we have been drawn by the love of Jesus, and we are here to show that we've been drawn by the love of people, the love of Jesus, because we are serving people. If you're not interested in serving people, if you're not interested in participating and loving them and doing things for them, then you've got to ask yourself, have you ever experienced the love of Jesus at all? Have you ever experienced the love of Jesus at all? True righteousness is completed in loving and serving. True righteousness and love is perfected in handing out a cup of coffee, working on a PowerPoint, taking care of a child. That's how you know that you love him. That's how you know you've experienced his love for you. And people come and they learn all the doctrines and they learn all the dogma, and they can trot it all out. But then when you see them, they have no interest in serving God's people. They've got no interest in serving and being part of that family. And you think to yourself, well, yes, you can trot out all the dogma, but what have you really understood? What have you really understood if you have no interest in building bridges and reaching out and spending time serving other people? Do you love Jesus? Great. Feed his sheep. You love Jesus? Fantastic. Feed his lambs. You love Jesus? Tremendous. Take care of his sheep. But we see that this takes us even further. We find there's a new star on the stage. Look at verse 18. Very truly, I tell you, you were younger, you dressed yourself and went where you wanted. But when you're old, you will stretch out your hands and someone else will dress you and lead you where you do not want to go. Jesus said this to indicate the kind of death by which Peter would glorify God. Then he said to him, follow me. And Peter turned and saw the disciple whom Jesus loved was following them. This is the one who leaned back against Jesus at the supper and said, Lord, who is going to betray you? And when Peter saw him, he asked, Lord, but what about him? So the past is forgotten. He's forgiven. And Jesus says to him, okay, you're going to love me and you're going to feed my sheep. This is what you're going to do. You're going to serve people and you're going to do it because you love me and you're going to do it for the next 30 years. And then Jesus takes him by the hand and says, come on, let's go for a little walk now. And they're walking down the beach, and John gets up and he starts following them. He's close enough to hear all this. And he says, this is going to be perfected one day. And I've got an amazing life for you ahead of you, but then one day this is going to be perfected in a way that you don't anticipate. There will come a day when you come to Rome, and you will be in what is Nero's circus, the circus of Nero, a place that Nero had constructed for parties. And he says, they will tell you that they're about to crucify you, and they'll give you a choice of being crucified the normal way or being crucified upside down. And you will choose to be crucified upside down, not because it's easier, but because you will not feel yourself worthy to be crucified the way I was crucified. And in the joy of loving Jesus and serving him and doing what you were meant to do, you will even say yes to crucifixion. And your death is going to be glorious because God is going to be glorified in your death. God is going to be exalted as you lay down your life. And your life is going to be meaningful because you will not have lived your life for your own desires, but you will have lived your life for me. And so even your death will be meaningful. Because you're not defending yourself with some kind of vague attempt at self-justification. But you've understood what it means to love me and to serve me and to serve other people. You're going to be crucified and I will be glorified. Now, if you're like me, you're sitting there thinking, he's going to be crucified. That's pretty rubbish. Excuse me, it's pretty rubbish. He's served Jesus for 30 years and now he's going to be crucified and that's supposed to be okay? But of course, we've forgotten, haven't we? People die every day. I don't know if you realize that, but the death rate is 100%. The death rate is 100%. And some people die in physical pain, and some people die in mental anguish, and some just slip away, they shuffle off this mortal coil, and without a whimper, and in 50 years they're forgotten, like they never were there. But the death of Peter made sense because his life made sense. And the death of Peter and his life impacts us now, 2,000 years down the line, and it impacts people from every corner of the globe, because on the 13th of October, AD 64, he stepped into Nero's circus and allowed himself to be crucified. And if you were to just walk behind Peter on that moment and say, Peter, are you okay with this? He'd tap on the shoulder and say, are you okay with this? He would turn back and say, never been better. And if he said, Peter, is it worth it? He would have said, of course it's been worth it. And he doesn't understand all this now. He turns to John and says, yeah, but what about John? What about him? And Jesus says to him, okay, you've been competing with John all the time. Even on the morning of the resurrection, you were running a race. This morning, John said, there's the Lord, and you had to get there first. Okay, all that competition stops because there is a new player on the stage. It is not about you living your life. It is about me living my life, doing something wonderful, and you are participating in the front row as I transform the world. I am living my life in you now. I am the center player. Jesus is the center player, and he is living his life in us, and we are participating in that. We are there watching him do wonderful things. He says, follow me. Enter my kingdom. Become like a little child. Let your life be about me and see the wonderful things I can do when you let me be the protagonist. And God is glorified. What does that mean, glorified? God is revealed. He is seen as being wonderful. And he satisfies people as he is glorified, as he is revealed. God will be glorified as you lay down your life in loving and serving, but then also as you lay down your life physically, as you let him take charge. When I was living in Rome, I would occasionally go to St. Peter's. I don't know about living in a big city. You live in a big city. It's not like you go to the city center very often. I was there about 7 years. I probably went to the city center 7 or 8 times a year. You just don't. But when I was living in Rome, when I did go to the city center, I would like to go to the Vatican. And that Nero's Circus is now St. Peter's Square. And I would love to go into the Vatican and walk into St. Peter's Church. And of course, it's huge, massive, you know, and you'd walk in like 10 minutes just to get to the altar. And I would walk down to the altar, and I would love to go, underneath, I don't think so do it, but underneath the altar, there was a little staircase, and you would take the staircase down, and you would find yourself in the first century catacombs underneath the altar, and it all becomes a lot simpler and plainer. And right underneath the altar is the tomb of St. Peter. Now, I'm not a great one for relics, okay? I'm not a great one for relics, but yet this old Protestant here felt something, standing there, so close to the great man, standing there where he was buried. And I would always stand there and I would look at dear old St. Peter's tomb. And I would say to myself, you know what? If God was able to do that through that, to do what he did through that man, because that man obeyed, what can he do through me? What can he do through me? What can he do through you? What can he do through you? Should we pray?